Time again for Midday on Health with Dr. John Smarr. It's spring and there's a lot to talk about, starting with pollen. After the long winter of the polar vortex and the chilly rains of spring, a pent-up tree pollen count exploded over the weekend to 2014's highest point. Counts from oak, maple, and poplar trees are expected to be very high in Maryland this week as the so-called pollen vortex hits the mid-Atlantic. We'll also be talking about the related subject of asthma, plus springtime injuries that come into the ER, and medical school. As graduates head off to their residencies, what lies ahead for them and the patients of the teaching hospitals where they've just been assigned. Midday on Health with Dr. John Smarr, after the news. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's here. Thank you for joining us for the second hour of today's show. It's the Midday on Health Spring Edition. We're joined, as always, on the second Monday of the month by Dr. John Smarr, physician and infectious diseases specialist at Sinai Hospital here in Baltimore. Dr. John, nice to see you again.
Wonderful to see you, Dan.
In this hour, we're going to take a look at the match, that time of year when medical students are matched with hospitals for their residencies. The New York Times had an interesting piece recently questioning the preparedness of medical students when they first start practicing medicine. You can find a link to that essay on my Facebook page. We'll talk about the effectiveness of the residency program, as well as the so-called July effect, the belief that more medical errors occur in teaching hospitals as a result of these just graduated medical students starting their residencies. So we'll talk about that with John today. Also, spring injuries, springtime in the ER, I call this, yes, with the past winter being especially long, right, and cold. And many people have been, eager to get out there and do things. And they start up the chainsaws, the weed whackers, the lawnmowers, certainly. So we'll talk about some of the more common injuries that arise when the temperature does. And speaking of the long winter, we had the polar vortex, right, John?
Yes, we did.
Which caused one of the coldest marches on record. And supposedly, and I heard this was some media hype, the phrase pollen vortex. But apparently there's something to it. This is that pent-up pollen has finally been released. And over the past week or two, especially, it's gotten bad. Today and the rest of the week, the pollen count in Maryland from trees, pollen from trees is projected to be very high. But it's not a lot of hype from what you see. This is a clever phrase the media came up with, pollen vortex. But it's particularly bad. Why? Because it's all happening at once? Or what's going on?
Yeah, and you know, I like the phrase pollen vortex for its sensationalism. I not only think of polar vortex, but I think of those bad movies on the sci-fi channel, Sharknado.
Oh, yeah.
So that'll be the next one.
Yeah.
But the idea is that the result of having the longer period of cold temperatures that we did impacts what the natural cycle is for pollen and things to be liberated out into the world. Usually trees are the ones that germinate and sort of have their pollen come out first. And then you have, that's early spring, and then late spring, summer is when you have grasses and other flowering things. And then in the fall, of course, you've got ragweed and things like that. And so the theory with regards to what we're seeing right now is that you have a late winter, we've had a lot of rain, and so what all that has done is it's suppressed both the trees sort of blooming with their pollen, and has sort of been washing it all away. And now we're getting a little bit later, and suddenly the weather's getting better, so not only are the trees dumping out all of their pollen, but at the same time, they've been delayed enough that it's at the same time that the grass is also kicking up its pollen. So it's we're getting this massive hit of these things all at once that usually, if we didn't have quite the long winter, would be more staggered out, so it wouldn't be quite as profound.
I get you. Okay, so there's something to the pollen vortex happening right as we speak, actually. Over the weekend, I was looking at my car, and it was covered with this greenish-yellow film. You probably saw it, too.
Both of my cars are black, and now they're green.
Greenish-yellow, dusty, right? And it didn't bother me, but I was in the company of a young woman who was suffering. She was miserable. She was taking some drops. I guess she had a prescription of some kind. She's taking drops under her tongue, she said, for it. I guess it gets to the question, why does it affect some people and not others? Why, you know, you go 20 years through your life, it never bothers you, and then at the age of 25 or 26, you're sneezing like crazy in May.
Right, right. Well, I mean, there's actually a lot of interesting things in that, in sort of that observation, and there's still a lot of things that we don't entirely understand. Before we get to that, it's worthwhile to note the other thing that people bring up when they talk about the pollen vortex and, of course, the environment is whether or not there is a role for global climate change or some of those things that we're seeing to be impacting what's going on with regards to pollen from year to year. Because people have been perceiving, you know, over the last few years that it seems like every year you hear allergy, this is the worst allergy season, or these are the highest pollen.
Some of it is media hype.
Yes,
but some of it you think is related to climate change.
Yeah, and so the theory behind that, I mean, there's probably a little validity to it. It's nothing that's easy to prove. But the validity would be that, you know, as we're having more carbon dioxide trapped in our atmosphere, if we're looking at sort of the fundamental structure behind what global climate change means, the thought is that that might be a trigger for plants not only to maybe grow a little bit bigger, but those type of environmental, like sensing composition of things in the air, that's a lot of how what stimulates plants to grow and do different things. And so maybe that's stimulating actually them to produce more pollen than, let's say, 10 years ago, plants actually did. Now, as to the question that you brought up of why is this bothersome to some people and it seems less bothersome to others, and some people you have problems when you're a child and other people it's you're fine, and then suddenly you hit some year and it's almost like your warranty was up and you're suddenly being affected by these things.
Right.
And that's not a good thing to think about, one's warranty being up,
right,
of course. But the issue is that essentially what it goes down to, what is an allergy? And an allergy is essentially a response of certain parts of your immune system to something that is harmless, because pollen doesn't do us any harm. It's not it doesn't have any toxic effects on the body. It's just something we're exposed to in the environment. It doesn't matter to our bodies one way or the other, but somehow we are developing a reaction to it. And that's true for, of course, any type of allergy, food, pet dander, things like that. And so the thoughts are that the reason why people develop allergies, some of it they think is maybe genetics, because certainly we all know folks who may have allergies that say run in their families. But a lot of it is environment. And over the short term, there have been some nice theories that have come out as to why people will develop allergies. One is that you might be exposed to a certain allergen at the same time you have an infection with something else. Let's say you're dealing with a rhinovirus or dealing with a common cold. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, you went outside and you got a hit of a certain type of grass pollen in your face. That the fact that your immune system is responding to one thing might sort of cross-react somehow and cause it to also see this other thing that's totally harmless to you as a problem, and that you might develop an allergy that way. Something else that's true, though, that we know is that the things that you tend to grow up with or be exposed to, it turns out you tend not to be allergic to those things. So it may be that there's a certain type of a plant that you're not exposed to or until a certain, so like you move or...
I was going
to
say move. This is the most common explanation. It's a very mobile society we have, right?
Right, right.
I don't know what percentage of the population stays put their entire life. But there's certainly been, in the last half of the previous century and this century, people moving around a lot more. So you're exposed to maybe pollen, a certain pollen that you weren't exposed to as a kid.
Exactly. Right? You know, we live...
Simple as that.
Well, Baltimore and D.C. especially, but this corridor we're in, this is very migratory. You have lots of people who are coming in for a few years and then leaving. And
right.
So in this type of an area, you might expect to see those things.
So I would think it would be common for someone to take a child or themselves, go to a doctor and say, hey, you know, I never had this before. And you lived in Milwaukee until last week, right?
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. And you know, the other piece that goes along with this is this falls into the other rubric of my thing, which is infectious diseases, because it's been something that people will sometimes talk about. And there's probably something to it. They call it the hygiene hypothesis. They look at the fact, you know, you have a lot of people now who seem to be developing allergies, proportionately more and more than, say, decades ago. So is there something about us as humans? And the argument is made, which from a sort of a basic logic standpoint makes sense, and there does seem to be a little bit of evidence to support it, that, you know, with our use of antibiotics, with us trying to sanitize everything, as children, we are not being exposed as much to microbes. And there is a fair hypothesis to say that because our immune system isn't being stimulated by being exposed to all of these infections, infections.
Mm-hmm. Being that trained, actually, trained essentially.
Right, right. And so essentially it shunts into a different pathway and it makes you hyper-reactive potentially towards these things that, again, these
what do you think of that theory?
I think there's something to it. I mean, not only is it really interesting to think about, but the sort of the studies that have been done are population-based studies. And so we know that in terms of looking at lots of people and the prevalence of allergies, industrialized nations certainly have more allergies than nations that are not industrialized. Folks that have, say, from certain countries where parasitic infections are very common, like, for instance, tapeworms, seems like that they don't have quite that allergic response that other people do. And they've even tied it into, because of one of my interests, is antibiotic stewardship. The idea that we're using too many antibiotics, and if you hear my voice getting hoarse, that's because of my own allergies going on right now.
Do you have an allergy problem?
Really? Oh, yes. Since I was a young child. That's my legacy from being in Ohio.
How does it affect you?
I actually have asthma, a couple. So this is all in my wheelhouse from a personal standpoint since I was a young child.
We're
going to
be talking about asthma today, too, as well. Just one last thing about allergies. I noticed this a news story here about the Food and Drug Administration. The FDA says it's approved the first tablet in the U.S. for gradually reducing hay fever symptoms, an alternative to months of weekly doctor visits for uncomfortable allergy desensitizing shots. So you could get, I guess this must be over the counter?
No, this will
be by prescription.
These are going to be by prescriptions, and they're not, and this is really interesting because what this is speaking to is, in medical lingo, we would call it immunotherapy, but the thing that everyone will know it by is allergy shots. So this is essentially a pill version or an oral version of an allergy shot. And what an allergy shot is, for those who don't know, is the idea that if we take a little bit of, like, you do a skin test, you figure out exactly what you're allergic to, and then we take a very tiny concentration of it and expose it to your body, and we keep giving this to you, say, over the summer months. The idea is we're sort of desensitizing your immune system. You're training on the short term your immune system not to react. So therefore, when you go outside and do things outside, you're not going to have as profound an allergic response or an asthma response if your allergies trigger that to those things. In other countries, for a number of years, they've actually had the ability to give this type of material through an oral pill that you dissolve under the tongue or liquid you put under the tongue, as opposed to shots, because obviously shots are a little bit more intensive, and pills are something that everyone would be very easily comfortable to use at home instead of going to your doctor.
So this is special because it's specifically for certain grasses. Is that
right?
Right.
So allergies, there have been. Yeah. Right. So there are three, actually, that the story you're looking at was talking about one that was approved, but there are actually three that were approved. The one that I think that story was talking about was something called Oralair.
Oralair.
Which is, yeah.
Oralair.
Right. And that's for five different types of grass. And another drug company has had FDA approval for a different one called GrassTech, which is for one type of grass, and the uncumbersomely named Ragwitek, which is, as you might guess, for ragweed. And so we're not quite to ragweed season. But these are interesting specifically because it seems like they've had a lot of success with these in other countries. And now that the FDA has approved them, and so we can actually more easily prescribe and they can be marketed in the U.S., that there may be some positive effects that we can see.
John, this AP story says 60 million Americans have hay fever. Fewer than 3 million are treated with allergy shots. So that means most people just take something that is over the counter to relieve sneezing and
exactly. Yeah. And so you're either getting other medications from your doctor or doing things over the counter. I had allergy shots actually when I was a young child, mainly because I had severe allergies. My allergist did a skin test and figures that the joke was I was allergic to everything green that grows and makes pollen. And so there was a period of time where I was getting allergy shots. But the problem is that you actually have to go into your physician regularly, say weekly, to get this shot. And there's very few people who are able to give this to themselves conveniently at home. And so that's the promise of something like this, is maybe more people can get this type of treatment because it's easier for them to take.
There must be already products like this on the market. because the person I was with yesterday was doing drops under the tongue versus a shot.
Right, exactly. And so it is still conceivably possible for people to have been able to get this in the U.S., but more likely this was probably something that was over the counter that may not have been the exact same thing. And possibly
even... So this
even,
is new.
So this is brand new. What we're talking about, this was approved this past month in April that just ended. So.
And you use the word trigger there. Specialists in asthma talk about the triggers, the things that trigger asthma. So pollen,
exactly.
Allergies trigger the asthma.
Right, right. And so allergies are one of the many things that trigger asthma, and pretty much anything that can sort of stimulate your body to have the asthma reaction. And what asthma is, of course, is you have your airways clamp down. They get tighter, so it's harder for air to move. And you stimulate, your airways get inflammatory. That's not the best way to say it, but you make mucus. It gets irritated. And so that can be in response to allergies. It can be a response to smoke. So cigarette smoke is a big thing, cigars, but even campfires or other natural fires as well, perfumes. It turns out that sometimes certain hormonal cycles, like there are some people who have more issues with their asthma during pregnancy when they are pregnant because there seems to be a hormonal component as well. And then, of course, even things like strong emotions or stress can certainly cause a reaction that can trigger it. Yes.
Dr. John Smarr is with us. Another hour of Midday on Health. Dr. John Smarr, physician and a specialist in infectious diseases from the from Sinai Hospital, but he's also program director in the internal medicine residency program at Sinai Hospital. And when we get back, we're going to talk to him about that, about the match season that just finished up, right?
Yep. Yep.
Medical school graduates going off to residencies, and we'll speak about the July effect. Also, springtime in the ER, and a little bit more on asthma here when we get back with John Smarr. You can join our conversation if you have a question about anything we've covered so far or we'll be covering this hour at 410-662-8780. Our midday email address for a question for Dr. Smarr, midday@wypr.org. Let me get that right. Dr. John Smarr, physician, infectious disease specialist based at Sinai Hospital, program director in the internal medicine residency program at Sinai Hospital. And we're going to talk about that in just a moment. I wanted to go back to this allergy story from the FDA regarding the approval of this tablet.
Mm-hmm.
And that number that I cited, 60 million Americans have hay fever, fewer than 3 million actually get the shots. I can understand why a lot of people don't want to get the shots. So this... For folks who have been doing over-the-counter medications to deal with their allergies every April and May, this could be a good thing because it actually could relieve some very severe syndromes even beyond what the over-the-counter medicine can do, right?
Right, and I think that's a key point, is that certainly I would not recommend this as being a first-line type of a thing for people. And a lot of what we have over-the-counter are things that even a few years ago, like Claritin, were actually completely in the domain of prescriptions. The main thing that your body releases when you have an allergic reaction, or one of the main things, is a substance called histamine. And so that's why you hear things, antihistamines. There are a couple of different types. Benadryl, which is the easy one that everybody knows, the most recognized one, is one of the types. And it works, but a lot of them have more side effects, like making you sleepy, which oftentimes people will take Benadryl specifically for sort of the sleep thing, as opposed to just controlling the allergy thing.
So how do you know whether you should go for something like this? Ask your doctor about Oralair tablets. I mean, how do you know if your condition is severe enough to take, or not severe enough to take that next step?
Right. Well, and that's actually...
Do you understand my question?
Yeah, no, I absolutely understand your question, and that's a perfect question.
Okay.
So the first thing is sort of, if somebody is having allergies and you're trying things over the counter, it's causing you problems. And of course, people who have allergies, it can be more in the eyes or more in the sinuses or more in the throat or more in the ears. But then the next step that they go is they go and engage with their primary care doctor. And so oftentimes we will use things like antihistamines, steroid nasal sprays, if they have asthma, the medications for asthma to try to control that. But the people for whom this type of therapy is perfect are those that it certainly seems that you have a seasonality associated with it. So like I said, trees, that's early spring, then usually, and then grass late spring, summer, and ragweed in the fall. So if you know that it sort of correlates with that, the next step, because this oral air at tablet actually has five types of grass, and they identify which ones they list. So sweet, vernal, orchard, perennial rye, Timothy, and Kentucky bluegrass. And so the allergist, if you go see an allergist, they can actually do an allergy test, a skin test for all the different types of grass. And so that way, if they prove, okay, you are having a very strong reaction to some of the types of grass that are in this pill, then obviously that would be, that's the type of person who that would be perfect for considering that in.
Just for the record, the pollen cast from the Weather Channel for the Baltimore region, the most active trees this week, oak, maple, and poplar. So that pollen will be out in the air, and the pollen count is expected to be very high all week long. One last question on asthma before we move on to our other topics, John. Baltimore leads the state in asthma mortality with 34 deaths per 1 million people versus 14 deaths per 1 million statewide. This is from the Baltimore City Health Department's website. Baltimore also has the highest pediatric asthma hospitalization rate in Maryland and one of the highest in the nation. Why? Do we know why?
Well, there's a lot of factors potentially, and the thing is that we know that there's clustering in cities. So, for instance, saying that Baltimore has the highest rates when it comes to these numbers in the entire state, well, Baltimore is obviously the biggest city in the entire state. And so there are certain issues with regards to potential genetics. There's certainly pollution. There's things about living in the city environment as opposed to out in the country potentially. There's all these different factors that people have looked into. And this type of an association is something that's been seen a lot. The biggest thing, and of course we could spend lots or little time on this, but I think the most important thing is that and what many experts recommend is that if you have asthma or you're concerned about asthma, or if you have family members, especially young kids with asthma as a parent, especially if you don't have it and it's not something you can sort of relate to, it's very important, maybe more so than some other medical things, to make sure that you're very informed. And keeping track of things. So, for instance, the big expert guidelines would say that for especially if people have severe asthma, you should really keep a journal so that you and the people who are around you understand what are some of your triggers. If you know that being exposed to, say, dogs is a big allergic trigger for your asthma, that's not only important for you to know as the patient, but for other people around you, especially your child. If they're going over to, say, a friend's house or a friend's apartment for something, or going into a school environment and they run into a problem, these type of things are very key to know. It's also important to know how your own symptoms are doing, because that's the type of questions that I, as a physician, will ask my primary care patients in terms of how often do you feel like you need to use an inhaler, or are you having any problems with shortness of breath or wheezing? And so these types of things can help your doctor and you decide, do I need to change my therapy? Do I need to make it more stronger? Do I need to do more things? Or if someone is exposed and having major problems, maybe that's the thing that's going to say, you know what, you may not be quite to this point yet, but you might have to go to the emergency room just to be safe. And since asthma attacks can sometimes, if they're severe, become very sudden, sometimes being able to catch it even a few hours or a day earlier can make all the difference in the world with regards to how that progress goes.
Is it very clear when you have asthma? There's no doubt about it. I mean, you people who have asthma, they have severe symptoms. There's no subtlety about this, I guess that's my question.
Well, I guess that's actually another very good question, because
is it?
Because
is it, really?
It is.
That's
it's
two
a stellar.
Today.
It's a stellar question. You are on a roll, sir.
2 in 90 minutes. That's pretty good. Let's see how I can do in the next half hour.
Exactly.
Go ahead, John.
So why that's such a good question is that a big piece about asthma is that it's not, there are objective tests we can do to document how bad someone's asthma is. There's something called spirometry, which is essentially a complex breathing test that can be done in a doctor's office to see how your, to measure how your different areas, different airways in your lungs are functioning. But most of what asthma is it's very subjective when you're talking about, are you short of breath? Obviously, if someone's wheezing, you can hear that if you listen to their lungs. But some of these things like shortness of breath and cough, these are things that people are reporting that they're experiencing. And there's been a lot of research to show that sometimes you can't actually trust how people are feeling in terms of the symptoms they're experiencing and how that correlates to exactly how their lungs are functioning, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I'll follow you.
Yeah, there's a lot of data to show that sometimes people will be feeling like they're severely short of breath, which is very important to recognize and to deal with, but you measure their lung function and it's actually pretty good. And otherwise, especially in long-standing asthmatics, you may sort of get used to what your baseline is, and so you may not view some worsening symptoms as quite being as severe as they really are in terms of heralding that, oh, you're about to have a major problem. And so that's why that's important, is because there sometimes is this dissociation between how someone feels and how bad their lung function actually is.
Do some asthmatics actually move in the hopes that the environment will affect their quality of their life, will reduce the symptoms?
Yes, I had a patient who did that last year. He moved to Arizona.
I've heard that people moved to Arizona for that reason. And do you have any idea how he's doing?
The last time I have touched base with him since he moved out there, and he perceives that things are significantly better. And I can tell you that when I travel to Arizona, I don't have nearly as many problems. So there you go.
Dr. John Smarr with us for another edition of Midday on Health. This is our spring edition. I want to turn now to the match, that time of year when medical students are paired with hospitals where they'll be undertaking their residency. And John, I know we talked about this a couple of years ago, when you were on the program here. You're a program director of the internal medicine residency program at Sinai, and you also had some experience with Hopkins residents as well.
Yep.
So first of all, the match that takes place, that took place, what, a couple of weeks ago?
That was actually, it feels like it was only a couple of weeks ago. It was actually middle of March.
Was it really?
Yeah. Okay. But it was only a month and a half ago. But,
okay.
Yeah.
And those medical school graduates will get their residencies will start in the summer?
That's correct.
They get a break here?
Yes.
Okay. There was a New York Times piece that I wanted to talk about a little bit, questioning the preparedness of med students. And I just want to read, this is by Pauline Chen, who recalling her days as a medical student in her first residency. Let me just read this to you. She said, "We had all endured 4 years of medical school, and we believe that all of our lectures, exams, and national standardized tests had made us ready to be real doctors, or at least capable interns. But the reality was that in some cases, we were unable to carry out even the most routine duties. The intern, who did get the patient's blood on her first try, had plenty of phlebotomy experience in medical school. But she confessed she didn't know how to prepare a patient for surgery and had to ask another intern to write the pre-op checklist on an index card that she could keep in her white coat pocket. The intern who wrote up the checklist came from a medical school where students prepared a lot of patients for surgery, but rarely did anything in the operating room. When asked to assist on a minor procedure during her first week, she had been so awkward and unsure of herself that the scrub nurse burst out laughing. Memories of those anxious first months of internship rushed back recently when I read about a new effort to improve the transition between medical school and residency training in the journal Academic Medicine." That's this piece by Pauline Chen. You can read the rest of it. You can find a link on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. First of all, what did you think of her observations? And then what is she talking about here in terms of improving this transition?
Well, her observations, quite frankly, are giving me flashbacks to my own internship in 2001, because that is dead on. And it's very interesting because it gets to, and this has always been the case, but even more so now, where the role of the physician is changing in terms of how, with the new provisions from the Affordable Care Act and the way the healthcare movement in the U.S. is going, how doctors in general, not even residents, their role is sort of changing with regards to how they interface with patients in hospitals and how they're used. But it gets into this question that you would think would be obvious, but is actually not, which is, on day one, somebody graduates medical school. They're starting residency, and then the first year of residency has traditionally been referred to as internship. And so that's what we mean here. You are a physician, you have a medical degree, and you're going to go into this weird apprenticeship thing that we have where you're not paid a full salary, but you are paid a meager amount. And then you're going to go and get further training and experience. So it's not really school, but it's kind of like school. It's not really a job, but it is a job, absolutely. What skills do you need to know on the first day? Because this is training. You're still being trained. You're not going to be expected to know all of these things. But that is a perfect example that leads off this story. For instance, blood draws. In the real world, as a physician, do you do blood draws? And the answer for most people, the vast majority of people, is no. Like, as an attending physician in the hospital, most hospitals, you're not responsible at all, in the United States, I should say, for doing blood draws. Because in other countries where there are less resources, physicians may be the ones who are actually drawing the blood. And certainly in my own training, when I was in the VA system back in the day, I was at a VA hospital where they didn't actually have a phlebotomy service. So if you wanted blood by a certain time in the morning, then there would be someone who would draw it for you. But if you needed it at any other time, it was up to you to draw it. But the whole reason I go on this tangent is because in medical school, there's not a lot of focus on the practical expertise of drawing a patient's blood.
I'm a little surprised, only for this reason. When you're a senior medical student, that is, you know, last year, don't you get some sort of training on the job? Is there some sort of internship in your senior year, a sub-internship or something like that?
Right, absolutely. And so
wouldn't you have that kind of wouldn't you draw blood in an experience like that?
Right. No, another great question, Dan.
Oh, my God.
I know.
Oh,
seriously.
God. Still 20 minutes to go on the show, too.
So, for instance, in when you're looking at medical school from the standpoint, let's say someone's going into internal medicine. Mm-hmm. So what typically happens is that during your third year of medical school, you have a rotation of different things that they call clerkships. These are sort of like you having student experiences in all the basic core specialties. So you usually have a clerkship that's probably 2 months long in internal medicine. You've got one in OBGYN. You've got one in pediatrics and in surgery. And so it's not only giving you experience and learning, but in some ways, it's kind of you auditioning that if you don't know exactly what you want to do with your
life.
I'll get you. And then if you want to actually go into, say, internal medicine during your fourth year, then you can arrange things. And what we have in certain areas of the country, it goes by different names. So you have a sub-internship or a acting internship. But the idea is that you're sort of more acting like a first-year resident than a student, but you're still a student. And so the type of duties that you have, the difference would be, let's say you're a medical student and you're what do you do on your clerkship? Well, on your clerkship, you join a team in the hospital, a team of residents led by an attending physician, maybe even with other people like a pharmacist, nurses, things like that, who are taking care of patients. And so you may only have one or two patients, a small handful that you're sort of responsible for in terms of learning, because you're still getting your skills up. You're still refining how you approach doing an interview, talking with somebody, how you do the physical exam, maybe getting over your nerves about the whole concept of touching another person in this certain specific way to figure things out. Then when you get to your fourth year, though, the idea is that, okay, you've had this experience, so it's something you can build on. So maybe you can follow more patients when they're admitted to the hospital and work with them in terms of the care that the doctors are giving them. But at no point in there, in the context of this team, how the hospital system works, because this is a systems thing, we're not typically the ones at most hospitals who draw the blood.
Okay.
It's a nursing thing or a phlebotomy.
So that wouldn't
service.
Necessarily happen even in that scenario.
Right.
Okay.
But the funny thing about this, and what rings so true, is who do the nurses call if even the most expert phlebotomist can't get blood from a patient? They call that poor intern, which may be on day one, and maybe this is something that they knew, someone was having a bleeding problem, so we need to get their blood count. We need to get their hematocrit to know if they're getting more anemic. And then it leads to exactly what happens at the start of this story, is you've got these the least experienced people who the experts are saying, we're not able to do this. And but that's actually been something that people have known for a long time. And it's a dichotomy of how the hospital works sometimes.
And John, does this usually happen in July when residencies begin?
Right. So the July effect.
We're going to talk about that after
the
break.
Yes.
So we'll tease that a little bit. That's this idea that more accidents or medical errors occur in hospitals in July when residencies begin. Midday on Health with Dr. John Smarr. We'll hear whether that's fact or fiction when we get back. Some people are more worried about that than I think the facts support.
That is correct, yes.
Okay,
yes.
But I want to hear a little more when we get back. 410-662-8780. Our phone lines are open. If you have a question for John Smarr, Dr. Smarr is with us for the remainder of the hour. It's Midday on Health. Yes, Midday on Health. Dan Roderick's here with Dr. John Smarr. A question, I wanted to step back a bit before we get to the July effect on in terms of residencies. Medical school. All right, a young man, young woman really wants to be a doctor. Really wants to be a doctor. Doesn't get into medical school. Graduates with an undergraduate degree. Spends a year preparing for the MCATs. Right?
Yep.
Apparently doesn't do that well. Still wants to be a doctor. What's your advice?
Well, I think the most important thing is to have sort of a sense of what it is that you want to do. And so, and this is sometimes, that's sometimes not a fair thing to say, because a lot of times folks have a very good sense that they want to be a doctor, but they don't really know what type. Like, do I want to be internal medicine? Do I want to be a surgeon? Do I want to do private practice? Do I want to live in the hospital all the time as a hospitalist? And why I think that's important, because there are several options for someone like that. And that doesn't mean that you say that you shouldn't be a doctor. But the sad reality of the way the medical profession is that you can be the best clinician in the world, but you will always be taking tests for the rest of your life. And so it's actually important to be a very good test taker, which isn't exactly the same as being very smart and having lots of medical knowledge, because there are certain skills, there are certain ways that we take tests that can hamper someone who even knows everything from a knowledge standpoint. So what I usually would say to someone like that is, first of all, go ahead and apply to your regular medical schools and see what happens, because if you get accepted, then suddenly your MCATs, no one's going to care. Once you get into medical school, no one's going to care about your MCAT scores anymore. I've long since forgotten what it exactly did on mine.
First of all, it is possible, even if your MCATs aren't that great.
Right, absolutely. Now, granted, it's going to significantly decrease your chances if you don't perform as well, because, of course, you have a lot of highly competitive people who are interested in going to traditional medical schools. There are more traditional MD degree medical schools that are opening in the U.S., partially given our need for physicians. Mm-hmm. That said, there are two other routes that people often take. One is to go to what's called we've actually talked about this, I think a couple of years ago, osteopathic schools, DO schools, which, just because of their relative newness, and I would open a whole can of things, you could spend a whole hour talking about that, but they tend to be easier potentially to get into. The third option, which is sort of the diciest, but sometimes can be successful for people, is the idea of going to a medical school that's in the Caribbean or that's in another country. And usually these schools, they have a bad reputation in many circles, not because the schools themselves are bad, but because there have been many people have had a history of seeing folks who just aren't good students and may not really be cut out to be physicians, who are able to get into these schools easily and then graduate and then come back and perform poorly. So there is sort of a stigma against these schools, which is to some degree warranted, but not entirely true, because I've experienced excellent, excellent graduates from Caribbean schools as well.
And what about going to graduate school during that interim while you're waiting to ramp up for another MCAT?
That is another great idea. And in fact, the types of things, and again, it depends on what you want to do. A lot of people choose to get a master's of public health, especially if they're interested in going into a specialty like, say, infectious diseases, women's health, urban health, things like that. Mm-hmm. That will definitely prepare you and possibly increase the chances that you could also get into a medical school and go where you want to go. The other thing is that more and more, it's still something we don't do a good job on is training physicians to do well in business. And so the idea of doing an MBA or doing, there's a degree called an MMM or a Master's in Medical Management that is specifically a master's graduate degree to train you from the business stuff, but specifically in the hospital and the healthcare setting. These are also things that I think could give you skills that might put you above other applicants, let alone being very useful to you down the line for your career.
Very interesting, John. And one last thing about that. If you're in that graduate school, even if you stop short of getting the master's, at least you've started the school, you could still, say, 1 year in, apply for medical school again.
Yeah, absolutely. Right? Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. Back to graduates of medical school. Now we'll push things up for those who actually got into medical school and graduated and went off to residencies. This idea of the July effect, you can look it up, folks. It's a term of the trade, a term of art. July effect, that is the concern of a high risk of medical error in the month of July when medical school graduates are starting their residencies. And before the break, you said you don't think there's a lot to it. What's the research show on this, John?
Well, that's the key piece, is what does the research show? Because at the end of the day, a lot of what we talk about in terms of medical things, there are a lot of things that crop up that are common wisdom, that they make logical sense. Like, you would think that if you have a hospital that's a training hospital, like, for instance, Sinai, we have a lot of residents in many, many specialties. And so you know the turnover date is going to be, for us, it's actually June 23rd, but it's usually the end of June or July the 1st, that suddenly you have the most experienced senior residents all leave to go get jobs or go into other training, and then you've got the crop of people who, as noted in the article, are still trying to figure out what it is that they want to, like make sure that they understand where the bathroom is, right, let alone trying to worry about someone calling them to draw blood because someone is a challenging blood stick. And you would think that in that environment, certainly there would be increased risks or increased problems to patients, because you just had this influx of physicians who are much less experienced. And of course, the other subtle thing is you've got the interns who are just interns this last year that have now moved up to be second year residents who are now supervising. So you have people who are debuting a new skill set of not just functionally doing the intern things, but they're also now in this new role of supervising people who are brand new.
Right.
So you would think that obviously in this type of an environment, what I just described to you, that this would be something that's a setup for potential mistakes.
Fraught with risk.
Yes, exactly. And I think the counterpoint to that, before we touch on sort of the studies that have been done, is that it's not like people don't know this, and it's not like that people in a training hospital are not very acutely aware that this is the situation that they're dealing with their trainees. And so I would say that the attendings, the physicians who are teachers, who are also working with these residents to take care of their patients, are going to be far more focused, especially right in the beginning, and making and staying longer hours and making sure that there's enough supervision there so that when these uncertainties come up, that the chances of them potentially resulting in medical errors that are more than, say, what the baseline is going to be lessened. The interesting thing is that there have been a bunch of studies looking at this. Most of them aren't very good studies. They've been sort of like someone looking at their own hospital.
Not comprehensive enough.
Right. Yeah. So, and the other problem with these type of studies is, what are you trying to look for? Like, what's going to prove that the July effect exists? So are more people going into the hospital and unfortunately dying, say in July, compared with other times of the year? Or are other errors occurring during July than other times of the year? And it's very interesting because some of the best surgery studies, there was actually one in the Journal of Neurosurgery last year that was specifically looking at spinal surgeries. And what they found was that there was no difference in the month of July compared with all the other months, compared with outcomes, so how well the patients did, complications. And you would think that complex surgical procedures would be the most sensitive to having inexperienced people coming in and trying to be a part of them. The biggest study that people have talked about recently...
Excuse me, I need to ask you, yes, do residents get into programs like that, neurological surgery?
Well, typically no. And so that's the other piece is that so for instance, in this case, to do neurosurgery, residents would have to do a surgery residency first.
I mean, even be in the first year in the OR, even doing prep work, would they even be involved in that? They could be.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Oh, absolutely. Okay. Yeah. Just doing the basic OR things, certainly.
The other thing I wanted to say was it seems to me that the attending is the one who's responsible ultimately, right?
That
so the
is
attending
very true.
Isn't just going to take the day off and let a resident have his way on the first day of the first week on the job, right?
Exactly. And so, for instance, what we do and what many hospitals do is we sort of have the expectation that at least for the first month, if not longer, the number of patients that we allow the residents to take, their caps of how many patients to follow, we may lower those. We're going to have all hands on deck and people, the expectation is you may need to spend more time in the hospital, especially as the attendings who aren't working under the duty hours restrictions for residents in order to make sure there's direct supervision there.
So after reading these studies that you say aren't great, but everything else that you know, you conclude that it's a bit overstated?
I think it's
errors
still
in July.
I think the biggest thing that happens in July that is definite is a decrease in efficiency. And there's no question. And even the studies, whether or not they seem to show an error issue or not, all point to the fact, and that's obvious. And one role now is as Medicare is more and more focused on using the electronic medical record to do reporting for quality measures. And so you have places that are adopting electronic medical records. It's not even just about interns coming in on the first day and not being prepared to do an emergency blood draw. It's also that they had to sit in some computer classroom last week and they got 8 hours worth of training and probably, like most people, didn't catch a lot of the subtlety of what was being taught, and then suddenly they have to place an emergency order or they have to figure out where a key piece of information
is. Slows things
down.
And
it slows things down.
Yeah. John, the last thing I want to ask you about today in our spring edition of Midday on Health, spring injuries, people are, you know, eager to get outside. I know the ERs get busy the more active people are, right?
Yes.
I assume that. Maybe the studies don't support that either. But I would assume the more active human beings are, the busier our emergency rooms become.
No, that's very true. And, you know, Sinai, we're looking at our own season because what's going to happen shortly? The Preakness. Where is Pimlico?
Oh,
Pimlico
yeah.
is
oh.
right across the
Do
street.
Do you work that weekend?
I have in my now 13 years that I've had experience at Sinai, I have managed never to work Pimlico weekend. Hmm. What I am told is that you get a lot of folks who come in very money, possibly not entirely sober, trying to pass out beer to people. You get lots of heat stroke. You get lots of injuries.
How have you avoided this duty?
I don't know, and I choose not to explore that lest I end up working that
You've already
weekend.
Broadcasted, John.
I have. Know? I'm setting myself up here
so
now.
So one last thing here. We just got a couple minutes. So your advice to people in the spring, what to watch out for so you don't end up in the ER in the springtime?
Well, I think the biggest things are that spring is all about, and especially now we're talking about the polar vortex, so things have been colder. It's people. You're now it's springtime. It's time to get things done, and especially now where there's been a lot of rain and everyone feels busier than usual, that you need to say, go cut your grass, clean your gutters, and you're not going to or cut down that tree. And you're not going to be as attentive to safety issues. You're going to quickly set up the ladder
because you're eager.
Because you're eager, or you may not go in and you haven't used this chainsaw in a year, and then you're going. I just need to run out real quick and take out down that tree because it's going to be a problem. And you're setting yourself up.
Of those
for all
you
sorts
just
of,
mentioned, what's the most common one? The lawnmower injury.
I would say that sort of general yard-based injuries, people cleaning their lawnmowers, interestingly enough, and you know, not turning them off or emptying them of gasoline beforehand. I've seen a few of those, or catching their foot. Ladders are it's not the most common, but to my mind, it's the most preventable and it's the most devastating because you can
falls
from ladders, severe head injuries, and those are very sad, obviously, to see.
Anything else you want to mention, John?
Well, there's always ticks, mosquitoes, those types of things, too.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. John, thanks very much for this. I enjoyed this hour with you again, as usual. Dr. John Smarr from Sinai Hospital joins us once a month, the first Monday of every month. Is that what this
is? Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. For Midday on Health, in addition to being a physician and a specialist in infectious diseases, John is the program director in the internal medicine residency program at Sinai Hospital. So thanks very much, and good luck avoiding ER duty on Preakness weekend.
I'll be okay? trapped in the pollen vortex, probably.
Okay. Thank you, John. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in today on Midday. Have a great afternoon. We'll see you again tomorrow.
Midday senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer and director is Jonathan Ahrens. The associate producer, Michael Himowitz. Our interns are James Daly, Tom Cartaxo, and Michelle Richardson. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming available at WYPR.org. Dan Rogic's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.